Hello, everybody, and welcome back to another Science Studio program. My name is Keith Pannell, and today we're going to be talking about drones. You've all heard about drones. They fly all over the place. Sometimes they take photographs. Sometimes they drop bombs. We're going to be talking about the use by the United States Geological Survey to do really good environmental monitoring, looking at all those things that wants to keep our country in sort of good condition. And our guest today is Jeff Sloan. He's from the United States Geological Survey in Denver. And Jeff, welcome to Science Studio.
All right. Thank you.
Okay, drones. I know you don't call them drones. I think you call them unmanned aerial systems. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct.
Right. But before we get on to that, let's learn a little bit about Jeff Sloan. How did you get into this business of being a geographer, geologist, drone flyer, and all the rest of it?
Okay, well, I started, over 30 years ago. I've been in the government that long, but I started clear back in college. I grew up on a farm in Iowa and always liked drawing and mapping. And when I went off to the University of Northern Iowa, got into geography, and I liked the technical drawing and the creative side of it. And they said cartography is where you could tie the two together. So geography became my major, and I went on from there to the Defense Department, and then worked my way over to the U.S. Geological Survey in cartography and mapping. And that, over the years, it was hand drawing back in the early days, but it evolved into geographic information systems. And that was just data layers that go in there to do your same type of mapping, only on the computers. And we've used aerial photography and satellites for years. Along came the drones, where we can fly at a little bit lower level and get, you know, spectacular imagery at a very low cost and learn
all sorts of interesting things.
Yes, and then all of a sudden we're now, you know, drone pilots. But really it's the data that we're after, so it was a natural fit.
You know, this whole business of cartography and maps, I have over the years done quite a lot of collaborative work in Russia. And I remember, you know, talking to my colleagues over there in Moscow that there was a period of time in the 50s and 60s where you couldn't get a good map of Moscow, all right?
Oh, yeah.
You know, because that had a sort of a political overtone, you know. The government wanted to know where you were, but they didn't want you to know where your colleagues were and how to get from one place to another.
Yeah.
And the best maps were ones given out by the United States Embassy, right? They had very good maps of Moscow.
Yeah.
But, I mean, so cartography has not just a utility in geography, geology, environmental science, etc. But there's a political issue there, too.
Oh, yeah. Always.
Right? Yeah. So, yeah. I mean, when you started your career, you said you were in the Department of Defense.
Yes.
What were you doing there? What was the idea?
Well, there's a whole department that maps for the military forces. And it's just standard series of maps, not unlike the USGS does. But we were just mapping the hotbeds at the time all around the world.
And so did you get to use, again, aerial photography and satellite photography in those early stages?
Yep, it was satellite and
and
planes. Anyway, we can get the data from above.
Right.
Yeah, we can make a map out of it.
And you like mapping because, as you said, you were, you know, very keen on that when you were in on the farm.
Right. Yeah, you have to be extremely accurate and technical with it, but yet there's creativity to it, too, in the mapping world. So it gives you both sides of it, which is great.
Yeah, one of the things I do is I sometimes collect old maps, and I got this beautiful map of Europe. But the nice thing is that longitude goes through Madrid because it was drawn by Spanish, you know, map makers, cartographers, and they didn't want to think about Greenwich. The Greenwich didn't exist in those days as far as they were concerned.
As you go from country to country, you'll see that the center of a map is often the country that
the capital, right? Exactly,
or the one they want to emphasize. And here, the United States is way off to the left-hand side.
So. Right. I mean, that's ethnocentricity and xenophobia, and we are always at the center of our lives, and therefore the center of the earth, I suppose.
Yep.
So, tell me now, what does the USGS? What's its interest in this drone idea that having these unmanned aerial systems, as you put them? You know, what is it that the USGS is really focusing on?
Well, we initially got involved in it clear back in the early 2000s, just seeing we could see some potential there in 2008, we actually created an office, a project office that could just see how these would integrate into the national airspace, which is still a big piece of it with the Federal Aviation Administration. So we're still working on that, but it's all about the correct policies, doing it the right way to get them into the national airspace. And that's a big part of what we've been doing. About 3 to 4 years ago, our director just said, let's get them going and see what we can do with them. So if they really are of use, then we can continue to invest into the technology.
So you have to get permission from the FAA to actually use these little airplanes.
Yeah, as a matter
drones.
Of fact, it's pretty extensive. Up till just some memorandums that have been signed between Department of Interior and the FAA, we had to do for every single area we went to, you know, an inch thick of paperwork just to get a 5-pound airplane into the air. It's pretty painful, actually.
And I mean, you say you get the 5-pound airplane into the air, but it's also for the amount of time. And then you've got to say, you know, what periods of time do you want to do this? And then you've got to plan that in advance. And, you know, if a big storm comes through that throws everybody off, and do you have to redo the paperwork, or do they give you a certain slack based upon weather?
Yeah, there's a time period. So we'll do all the paperwork, and a lot of it is standard paperwork that we can use each time. The first time out was pretty difficult to understand what they were looking for. But, yeah, it designates a certain period of time, usually up to a year. So once we get all the approvals, then we just have to give notice to airmen or things like that.
Oh, so the permission covers a long period with a sort of restrictive time periods and altitudes.
Right.
And then when you're ready to actually deploy, then you simply notify someone and says, you know, this is USGS form number 35G, and we're going to activate it today at 10 a.m.
Yes,
or something like
exactly.
that.
Yep.
All right.
We have to have designated times that we launch and land and done for the day. And
so give us some examples of what you've been doing over the last few years.
We've done a lot of work for our sister agencies within the Department of Interior, in particular U.S. Fish and Wildlife. So we do a lot of bird census counts, waterfowl in particular, elk surveys. And then on national parks, we've done some dam removals. They removed 2 dams up in the Olympic National Park area to restore the lake back to the river. We've flown in there.
Well, let's talk about elk for a moment.
Okay.
Because the area around here has got some beautiful elk up there and reserves of elk. What did you do? What was the point, and how did you go about doing it? As a census count?
Yeah, the Fish and Wildlife Service has the responsibility to do a census-type count on a lot of animals throughout their refuges. And to look for an elk is difficult. In Washington State, the trees, you know, as tall as they are there, it's like looking for a needle in a haystack. And these are limited to a pretty small area. So when you're at 400 feet, you can't cover a lot of area.
So that's the height normally of of your...
Correct.
We unmanned aerial systems.
Yes. We usually we have to stay below 400 feet unless we get special permission to go above that. But with the cameras that we have, it's a good height to fly at. But we're looking for elk, and they're mysterious anyway. They can disappear real quickly. But we went down to California, and we had a little more luck, mainly because we kind of knew where they were, so we could direct the plane over that direction. And we weren't as excited about it, but the biologists are. Just a year prior, they had had a helicopter go down and kill some of their biologists that were doing the population counts from the air in a helicopter. But they got a little more excited about it because they said they have collared animals and with GPS locations, so they can give us those real-time GPS locations, and usually the herds will hang together. So in that case, it would be useful. We could do counts that way.
I mean, elk are not exactly wandering around out there uncovered.
Right.
I mean, I see them up in the Sacramento Mountains, but, you know, they come out very cautiously at sunset,
right?
You know, and it's in the shadows, and otherwise you never see them unless you're actually a hunter. You're going looking. Mm-hmm. But so that was a useful tool.
Difficult. Waterfowl and birds, and that is a whole lot easier because if we stay high enough, they don't get as skittish and fly away on us.
So they actually then do counting. Mm-hmm. I mean, do you have some undergraduate students or high school students? You give them a photograph, blow it up, and say, count.
Well, you could do it that way, but we like to let the computer do the work. So we do some feature recognition. It'll recognize a pattern and then do a count that way. And it works fairly well. You still have to have a person make sure you're not getting a false.
So before the use of these drones, this was done by helicopters and then people on the ground just going in from certain days and saying doing a spot count in order to learn about population density of different species.
Yep, that's correct.
Right.
As a matter of fact, our very first mission was sandhill cranes down in southwest Colorado, and we did have field count people, the biologists counting from the field, and then they kept their numbers separate, and then we went ahead and flew ours and did our counts that way, and I think we were about 3% difference.
Okay, I mean, that's,
so they were pretty excited.
Well within experimental yes. error. I mean, if you could reproduce science at 3%, you've done pretty well,
yeah, then
at least in chemistry.
You have a viable option to,
okay.
to maybe use that technology.
Has this unmanned aerial systems really replacing a lot of the people on the ground, boots on the ground, trying to do this monitoring?
Well, that question comes up a lot, of course, but we never see a need for that person on the ground. You always want some type of verification, and it may not be as many people, and they may not have to rely on it, but really it is a viable option, and they could probably do it more frequently at a whole lot lower cost because you don't have the labor to get those people out there. So it's just another tool in the toolbox.
All right.
You always got to have a human verifying the truth of it all.
And presumably in terms of species and rarity and endangered species, there's a size feature here too. I mean, elk are nice and big. Birds are reasonably big. But when you get down to, I don't know, chipmunks, I mean, you've got to go to a different methodology of counting.
Yeah. I just had a question yesterday. What's the smallest animal we've looked for? And I said a pygmy rabbit up in Idaho, but we were actually mapping its habitat. We couldn't actually see a little pygmy rabbit from the air unless we were really flying low.
How big? I mean, I have no idea what a pygmy rabbit looks like.
They'll
smaller
fit in
than
your
hand. Oh, really?
Yes.
Oh, so it's smaller than a chipmunk, maybe.
Yeah, it's about that same
size. All right. Are they endangered?
Yeah, they're getting close to that. And they were actually looking for their habitats to reintroduce them into other areas. The mapping of the land is pretty easy to do, and that's we end up doing that a lot. But I had questions yesterday, can you map lizards? And we're actually going to attempt to do Asian carp.
Up there in Michigan and in mm-hmm. the Great Lakes
in
area.
The Midwest, yeah.
You're listening to Science Studio. My name is Keith Pannell. I'm here today with Jeff Sloan. He's from the United States Geological Survey, and he's in charge, or he's the director of something called the Unmanned Aerial Systems. Drones to you and I. We'll be back in one moment. Welcome back to Science Studio. Keith Pannell, Jeff Sloan. He's from the United States Geological Survey in Denver. And we were talking about using these unmanned aerial systems to, in fact, look at populations of species and endangered species. But there are other aspects that you do. I mean, give us some other examples, because it's a very varied career you have,
yeah.
Right? I mean, have drone, will travel, right?
we are in demand, I have to say that. It can be as simple as fence line inspections. We've done that out in Hawaii, actually, for the National Park Service. Once again, fence line around the park just to keep feral animals out of there.
Right.
We've done coal mines several times out in West Virginia.
Coal mining.
Open coal mine.
Right.
For inspections. They're rehabilitating the area. So a lot of that has to be done by just a handful of people. And there's a lot of mining out there, of course. And they have a big responsibility to try to get to see if that is being rehabilitated correctly. So they were pretty excited when we can pop a plane up in the air and get archive video, or they can just see instantly whether things are not being done correctly, if there's breaches in ponds or something like that. So,
all right. So, I mean, that leads on to perhaps, you know, more in terms of law enforcement. It was trying to go over certain parts of the West and find out where are those damn marijuana plantations that were illegal. No, yes, that's not such a big issue now. But, I mean, are people interested in that too? And not just in the U.S., but let's say deforestation in Brazil, where it's such a big territory that they say we're losing thousands of acres of forest mm-hmm. to illegal cutting. I mean, is that something in the future, or are people using it now in Brazil?
I don't know exactly what's being done on that side. We tend to stay away from the law enforcement, although there's plenty of law enforcement in the Department of Interior. We I think it can be done with the right cameras and all that. I don't know how extensive it's being done, but yeah, they're certainly looking at it.
All right. Well, one of the things I noticed, I was looking on the websites about this business, and one of the interesting things, especially locally here in West Texas, southern New Mexico, is when you were sort of using your technology to look for dinosaur footprints up in the White Sands National Park. Tell us, how did that come about?
We work a lot with the Bureau of Land Management and National Park Service, their sister agencies under the Department of Interior. And they've actually had the responsibility and have been doing it, dinosaur tracks on BLM land or Park Service land for 30 years or even longer. And they used to do that by just setting up a tripod over top of the tracks. And when you're that low with a camera and you have stereo collects, just overlapping photos, you can create a 3D model. And that 3D model can be kept for years or analyzed if any of that gets destroyed or changed or any way. But up in White Sands National Monument up there, they had some woolly mammoth tracks that sand blows to and fro, and it exposes them. And then, you know, a few days later, it'll be covered back up again. So the plan there was to send a drone over it and collect the images. It has a GPS location on it, and they can fly fairly low, and we collect those images and make the 3D model the same way that we would with a tripod, only we can cover a whole lot more area. And then those are referenced with the GPS location. So the park was pretty excited about it. They had a 3D model of the tracks, you know, all down right. to a millimeter accuracy.
That's pretty impressive.
Yeah.
And in fact, in the studio with us today, we do have a typical aerial system. Okay, it's about, mm-hmm. 4 feet wide, mm-hmm. 4 feet long, doesn't weigh anything. Now, this isn't your traditional one. I mean, most people think of drones, I think they're thinking of sort of helicopter type, but this just looks like a model aeroplane
right.
with the nose cut out, so you put the camera in. Is that just a typical model?
Yeah.
And it's so light.
Most of them are, you know, 5 pounds and less.
Right.
Is kind of a target weight that the FAA is looking at regulating or not regulating below that weight. So they're quite popular. We like both a fixed wing, a traditional airplane, you know, looking like a model airplane.
Well, that's what this is.
Right.
I mean, it's just lovely.
And then
except he's got USGS plastered all over it, so
yep.
you can't – no one's going to shoot it down, right?
Right. Well, we hope. but then also the traditional – the ones you're seeing a lot of, the little helicopter, the quadcopter type
right.
Planes that are real popular with the hobbyist. But we see a need for both because, for one thing, the helicopter type are real easy to maneuver. They'll hover and point and stare and – we can direct them, and they're real easy to learn to fly. Whereas a fixed wing, we see the advantage there. It can fly a lot faster. It can cover a whole lot more ground, but it is harder to fly. If you are confused at what you're doing, you can't just say, you know, halt and let it float there.
Right.
It's still moving. So you really have to keep
Well, I mean, that brings up the sort of the question, obvious question. How do you do this? I mean, let's say you're down there in a national park and or up in the Great Lakes looking for fish. Where are you and where's the instrument? Where's the aerial system? You're right there with it, within
yeah.
a mile, or can you do it remote?
We can do it remote. However, one of the regulations is that we always keep our eyes on it. So there's usually a couple ways to fly them, either from a laptop computer. We'll set up tables, or if we're lucky enough to have a trailer out with us, we'll
right.
fly out of there. So we'll have our laptop set up and then a hand controller, and you can usually swap between the two. So we have control both ways if we ever run into problems. But we do have somebody keeping their eyes on it all the time. So really
– And that's a regulation from the FAA or just
correct.
Within the USGS?
No, that's the FAA regulation.
And
all it's
right.
pretty much for all the commercial and even hobbyists are supposed to always keep their eyes on it.
So, I mean, when you think about the news that we read, the different – I mean, Amazon wants to start delivering its goods by drone to your house. You know, there's talk about being able to use drones to quickly communicate between hospitals. I think the Mayo mm-hmm. Clinic. But there you can't keep your eye on the thing all the time, obviously. I mean, it's totally counterproductive.
Right.
You've got this vehicle going along the road watching the drone. You may as well mm-hmm. deliver it from the vehicle. So how is that going to transpire? I mean, do you get involved in the rules and regulations for using unmanned aerial systems?
Well, the FAA usually opens up lines of communication back to them on what is the need out there. Out of line of sight is a big one. That's what everybody wants to do. I think it's a ways off, but the FAA is taking it very carefully, and they're allowing it on certain cases like wildfires, as well as it tracks it on the laptop with
right.
GPS, so you really do know where it is. So.
But you just can't see it. I mean, and that's got to be the future of
yes.
unmanned aerial systems, I think.
Yeah, certainly.
Right? And you see that within 3 to 4 years or less
I think
or
so.
More? Right?
Yeah, I think so. At least in remote areas. You know, when it goes over the cities and populated areas, that's a different story because
yeah,
that's where
right.
the problems come. But if you're out in West Texas here or yeah. eastern Colorado, something like that, it's, you know, there's not a lot of harm it can do, really, if it gets too far away from you.
You imply, in fact, you stated that really you get requests for your system to be used for other people's problems,
mm-hmm.
all right? What does Jeff Sloan want to do with this? They give you a sabbatical, a year, and say, okay, Jeff, you've got the system. You know what to do with it. Go away and do your own thing. What would you really like to do with this system for yourself?
So that would be Sloan drones, correct?
Sloan okay. drone, that's right. Oh, someone's brought this up before. That was too quick.
We joke about it all.
Right.
But yeah, there's so many entrepreneurial things going on out there. We joke about it. But I love golf courses, to me, mapping golf courses. And it's actually
yeah, there's
a
man after my own heart. Sorry, you're a golfer.
Yeah, I'm a golfer.
Great, me
but
too.
There's a lot of applications.
I'm not a good golfer. Well, tell me a typical application then for golf courses.
For a golf course?
The golfer. Not for the maintenance of the course.
Okay.
I can see that because where it's dry, where it's wet, et cetera. But for the golfer, what's in it for the golfer?
Well, there's a lot of different angles, and it's real similar to the farming side of it too. But for the golfer, you can map the elevation models that we're able to create from them, as well as the high-resolution imagery. You could create custom putting greens that are extremely accurate on how that breaks, how that putt will break.
Oh, so it's going to be like watching TV,
yep,
right? When they say, now, here's the line. And it's the same technology they've already got, I guess, but now it's for the ordinary man.
Right. And then even expand.
So is that cheating? At what stage?
No, that's all legal.
Well, it's like the long putter. Do you like the long putter?
I personally don't like the long putter.
I think it is being banned, I believe.
Yeah, it is.
And, you know, it's and in fact, was his Nick Faldo really argues that anything that helps the golfer that's not the traditional golf ball, mm-hmm. even putting lines, you know, how some yep. people draw a line around it just to sort of line up the ball when you're putting, shouldn't be allowed.
Yeah.
Right? Are you of that ilk?
No, it's the rules of golf have been pretty well established and they've stuck to them. So if you kind of follow those guidelines, public knowledge is always legal.
Right.
So if you watch some of the professional golfers, they have their books and
right.
they're really doing the exact same thing.
Yeah.
They're learning over the years which way that putt will break. So
right.
they actually map it out.
Okay.
This is just another way to do it.
Well, I mean, enough of golf because just you and I are interested. Maybe the listeners aren't so keen. Let's go back a little bit to the agricultural use. Mm-hmm. All right, you come from a farm. Your brother still runs the family farm and
correct.
All the rest of it.
Mm-hmm.
What's the big utility for this unmanned aerial systems for farming?
Well, it's all about precision farming, and that has been around since about early 90s when they started with the yield monitors, and you could get specific yields on the go. So as you're combining a field of wheat or corn, soybeans, you're seeing exactly what those yields are at that spot, all tied to GPS. And if you go to the farming world nowadays, it's all GPS. They're highly technical. And this just provides the missing layer, really. You can put a camera in there that actually gets into the electromagnetic spectrum, right into the near-infrared. And that near-infrared holds a lot of information for vegetation, in particular chlorophyll and the health of that plant. And what it does is it will see a problem about a week to 2 weeks before that actually the human eye can recognize
so
it.
So if the plant there is a little dehydrated compared to what another section of the farm or what you think is optimum, you can detect that. And then with a few weeks advance warning, you can go in and do some reparation.
Yes, correct. And that's where the agronomist would come in, because they'll know specifically what that application will be. And it will be very site-specific. So it saves the farmer money by not blanket applying a chemical or nitrogen or water, something like that. And then on the back end, it'll increase the yield. So for the farmer, they're winning both ways. But you do have to have somebody that can interpret that data. And I think that's where, through the Midwest, it'd probably be a cooperative service that are all around there, or an agronomist.
Well, talking of your family farm, mm-hmm. is it used there? Does your brother have a little drone?
Actually, a person a couple miles away does, the agronomist that works with them.
Okay.
And she just started getting – she's real interested in it. So she's trying to follow the FAA rules on how to get it into the commercial part of her business. And then, yeah, in a couple hours, you can fly the entire farm of a person and in another day analyze that data and be doing the prescription to fix the problem.
And it's relatively cheap.
Yeah.
I mean, this is not a very sophisticated-looking airplane that I'm looking
right.
at here.
The systems,
the cameras are much more sophisticated.
Well, not necessarily. The systems we have are a little more expensive because of all the fancier technology. But really, you can get a model airplane or those hobbyist airplanes and put in a Best Buy or a Walmart-type camera that is really pretty spectacular imagery. And then if you really get fancy, you can modify those to get into the infrared. And you fly it just like you would a hobby. And you're covering your field, and then the data comes down. And even the data analysis is getting easier and easier.
Jeff Sloan, United States Geological Survey, thank you very much for being here. It's been fascinating.
Yeah.
And I'd like to come on a field trip with you one time.
Yeah.
Right.
If we get down to Texas, we'll invite you.
Yeah, go down to Big Bend and do something down there.
Okay.
Well, that's the end of this week's Science Studio. I'd like to thank Eddie Rosales in the cabin there for putting it all together, and Norma for doing the final editing, Norma Martinez. And we'll be back next week. And so thanks for listening. Bye-bye.